It is the Spirit that gives life, and you have to stay in the Spirit. And it's not between you and them. It's between you and God. And, you know, the more you become closer to God in this way, the more people will want to be around you. People respect strength, not weakness. People respect the person who can say, no, I just don't want to go there anymore. I don't want to go have the drink this time. That's what the invitation is about. That's why I think it's so beautiful. She wrote that, Uriah wrote that, after being at a party in which everybody was talking about their possessions. She said, I don't care what you do for a living. I want to know what you ache for. I don't care whether you agree or don't. I want to know if you can see beauty everywhere and source your life from its presence. I want to know if you can get up after a night of grief and despair, weary and bruised to the bone, and still do what needs to be done to feed the children. I want to know if you can resist somebody else's desire for your attention and not betray your own soul. That's the invitation. It's a great and powerful invitation. And that's what it means to put your energy and your attention always on what you intend to create. And then when it doesn't show up, you say, thank you for the lesson, but I still intend to manifest it. And when there's an obstacle here, you say, thank you, I needed that, but I still intend to manifest it. And I'm infinitely patient. Infinitely patient. I'm as patient with you as God has been patient with me. Through the worst, through the horrors, through the most terrible times of your life, you've always known that this higher self called God is there for you. You've known it, and it's never abandoned you. That's the kind of patience you have to have. Infinite patience. Okay. What I'd like to do now is talk about the St. Francis prayer, which are the last seven chapters of A Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. To me, this prayer symbolizes all that I mean by a spiritual solution to problems. It's what I've been speaking about here all of this time. In the face of something called a problem, it cannot survive when the higher and faster frequencies of spirit are brought to bear on the problem. It can't survive. And so St. Francis asks these things. And I'm just going to summarize and go through these rather quickly. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. What does that mean? It's clear in the scriptures that if you are not at peace, you cannot know God, because God is peace. If you're not at peace, you have sent God out of your life. And when you are at peace, you are in that calmness that we talked about earlier. Becoming an instrument of peace is you become a deliverer of peace. You deliver peace by being an instrument of peace. And you have options and opportunities every day to do it. I'll give you a couple of examples of just simple things of being an instrument of thy peace. I was getting gasoline at a gas station a few months ago when I was writing the book. And I got out of the car, I pumped the gas, walked in to pay for it, and there was a young boy there, and there was a car wash at the gas station where you put the coins in, you know, for $3 or whatever it is, or you pay up front. And there was a young man there who didn't speak English, who didn't know how to work the machine. And he didn't have any more money. He had given them $2, and it was $3 for the car wash, and that was all he had. But he didn't speak English very well, just very halting. And the cashier who took my money and treated me very nicely, but he was being extremely crass and rude to this young man. Very intolerant, creating a real atmosphere of disenchantment and angst. And the young boy was maybe 19 or 20, and he was almost in tears. Because when we don't understand someone in another language, we have a tendency to speak louder to them. We just keep saying the same thing over, but we say it like, if I raise the decibels, he'll understand this language, which is absurd. And he just kept getting more and more and more intolerant of this kid, and the kid just kind of, he didn't have any money left. So there I am standing there observing this. Now, no, my role is what? Get out of there and go home. That's where I was. I just filled up for gas. But when you're the instrument of thy peace, this is an opportunity to be an instrument of peace. And so I just reached into my pocket and I took out a couple of dollars. And I said, here, all you have to do is put this into the machine and just push this button. And I walked over with him. I gave the guy the money, walked over and showed him how to push the button. And he had the biggest smile and he just was a happy camper. Because it was like, it's very easy to diffuse a situation like that in a moment if you're willing to be generous. If you're willing to give up a dollar or a moment of your time. And you have opportunities like this all day long. And these opportunities aren't there because it just happens to be that this guy was there in your space. This is your test. These are all opportunities. And if you feel it inside that I could do something here, but I'm not going to do it. That's your intuition. And intuition is one of the components of the very fastest and highest frequencies. Your intuition. It's God talking to you. Here's a chance for you to be an instrument of my peace. Here's a chance. Make peace here. And you don't have to do it and say, look, I don't like the way you're treating this guy, and I think that you ought to be stopping it right now. I'm going to kick your ass. You don't do that. Because you become an instrument of hate, and you just join in, and you create more, and that's what created the problem in the first place. What you do is you just very silently say, thank you, God, for this opportunity. And then you just move in and do what your heart tells you. Go to your bosom, knock there, and ask what your heart doth know. Just ask. On the same day, we were having dinner with my family, my mother, my wife's mother and father, my older son and his wife, my oldest daughter was in from Hawaii, and all of the children. We were all having a gathering. And my mother and my wife's mother have a little thing going. My mother's 85, my mother-in-law's 75 or so. And they've got this little thing where one likes to sort of needle the other. And I adore both of them. And I deal with both of them with just a lot of humor. And when they give me a lot of crap, I say, you know, I expect crap from you. Thank you for giving me some crap today. You know, it's like, and that's how I deal with it, all very lightly. And so, and consequently, I get treated very nicely by both of them. And but when they get together, it's like there's this need to be right, you know. We always have this choice with ego, be right or be kind. The ego says be right, it's very important, win. Higher self says just be kind. Kind is a higher frequency, computes strong. Anger, disputes make you weak, always. Fighting makes you weak. So they were starting out, and I could see it coming, because after a while, you get to know what's going to happen. You could do it with yourself as well. I do it with my wife. When I know that if I say this, she's going to say that. And I can play this whole thing out. I can play out the conversation before it takes place. And then she's going to say this. And then I'm going to say that. And then she's going to, and then we're going to both be pissed. And then we're not going to talk for an hour and a half. And then we're going to, I can see all that. And instead I just say, you know, that's a good point. And it's all stopped. I've already had the argument. We've already had the hour and a half of silence. We've created what Blake calls the poison tree. It's all been there, but I just did it over here. Now, let's have this in our reality. That's a good point, you know. But then the part of me says, but she really is wrong. And she's saying the same thing. Then both of us are right. We're both wrong. Instead of allowing this evening's dinner celebration to become one in which two people are going to be creating an atmosphere of hostility and, you know, being, you know, and it's all petty. It's nothing. It's just all, most of the stuff in your life is, it's like that. You just diffuse it. It's just an opportunity to, oh, this is, you know, and you just change it. You just allow, you just interject something loving and instantly change the subject and you just rescue them from each other. Just a rescue operation. Excuse me, I think it's time for us to have a toast. A toast? We don't even have glasses. Well, let's have one anyway. There's nothing like a toast without glasses, you know? That's the best kind of toast. You know, in ancient Egypt, they always toasted without glasses because a glass interferes with our higher consciousness. You know? It doesn't matter what you say. You just... And all of a sudden, everybody's talking about, he is so weird. Why in the world would we do a toast without glasses? But this has all been diffused. This has all been diffused. And you have become an instrument of thy peace. Make me an instrument of thy peace. See how often in a day, you know, somebody drives by you and gives you the bird. And you just thank you, you know. It's just half a peace sign. He's halfway there. You know? Next time I see him, he's going to give me both fingers, right? Don't allow yourself to be sucked into the low energy of those who don't understand the consciousness level at which you are living. You have a spiritual... You're just going to be an instrument of peace. It's just going to be who you are. And you don't preach... And you don't get people to join your group, and you're not out there proselytizing and trying to win friends and influence people. You're just an instrument of peace wherever you go. And after a while, this becomes your consciousness. And you start radiating it out. And guess what? You don't even have to say anything. You just move in. And you move in with such peace. That consciousness alone radiates out from your energy body and people can't be in conflict when they're around you. That's how it works. Second, where there is hatred, let me sow love. Let me bring love to the presence of hatred. Listen to this quotation from one of my favorite poets, the Irish poet, William Butler Yeats. At certain moments, always unforeseen, I become happy. I look at the strangers near as if I had known them all my life. Everything fills me with affection. It may be an hour before the mood passes. But lately, I seem to understand that I enter upon it the moment I cease to hate. You cease to hate. You bring love to the presence of hate. It's been said that the most difficult thing in the world to do, there's three. One is to send love in response to hate. The second most difficult thing to do is to include the excluded. I always ask my children when they get into a talk about, well, Rebecca said this. Well, Rebecca, oh, that Rebecca, she's such a witch. And she wears the shortest skirt. And I'm wearing makeup. And you should see how she flirts. She was flirting with Dan Poynton. Like, if you, like, knew how much, like, she has flirted. And you're like, and you hear this going on, these teenage girls, it's like, six of them all sitting around, and I'll walk in, I'll say, excuse me, who's defending Rebecca? Which one of you is Rebecca's lawyer? Is there anybody here that will speak for Rebecca? And my daughter will say, oh, Dad, you're such a dog. He's just going to ruin, like, everyone, you're making my friends, and it's so embarrassing. I just wanted to know, because she's not here, and there's nobody speaking for her. How about if I do it? I'll take Rebecca's side, you know? And the third most difficult thing to do is to admit when you're wrong. Emotionally. Not to admit it intellectually, but to admit emotionally when you're wrong. To send love in response to hate. For ourselves, and when we encounter our own hatreds, it becomes the ultimate challenge. If that's all we have to give away, it's like the old classic orange that I've often given the example of. If you squeeze an orange, what do you get out? Which is orange juice. And why do you get orange juice from an orange when you squeeze it? Because that's what's inside. It doesn't matter who squeezes. It doesn't matter what time of day. That's what's inside. And if someone squeezes you, and out of you comes hatred, it isn't because of who did the squeezing. It isn't because of the time of day or the instrument they used. It's because that's what's inside. If you didn't have it inside, it couldn't come out. So you have to change what's inside. You have to send love inside and make yourself an orange that is filled with love juice. And that's what you send out. And that's what the great spiritual masters taught us. And we don't always do it. I certainly don't always do it. I do it much more than I used to because I'm better than I used to be. But I'm still not there 100% of the time. When I'm not there, I am conscious of it. And that's a start in not being there as frequently. And when my master teachers show up, like my wife, who I asked her one time, how come you never tell me when you have an orgasm? She said, you're never there. Thank you for sharing that with me. I'm only kidding. Of course you're there. She's always got, she knows how to do it, right? Sending love in response to hate. There was a woman who lived in England in the 19th century. Her name was Elizabeth Barrett. Elizabeth Barrett was a very famous poet. She had published some works, and some of them had been circulated throughout London. But she was kept in her home on Wimpole Street by a very tyrannical father who had her convinced that there was something wrong with her, that she was sick. And she had siblings, all of whom confirmed this, and they would never let her or allow her to do anything but stay in her wheelchair, sickly, and write her poetry. And they protected her, and they kept her from. And she wrote poetry about love. In fact, she wrote probably the most famous sonnet ever written that I wrote an essay about in Wisdom of the Ages to my wife. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. And all of the ways were about the soul and the spirit of this man who came into her life, who read one of her poems and said, I love you, Miss Barrett. I love you because of the poetry you write touches my soul from yours. And he came to her home on Wimpole Street, this big, bruising, enthusiastic, crazy, wild, full of life, passionate human being who wanted to just take her away from all of this stuff that was really inhibiting her in her enjoyment of life. And she resisted and was frightened because she was controlled by the anger and hatred of the parent, the siblings. But finally he persuaded her that she didn't have to be sick because he brought a different energy field into her life. And he stole her away one night and moved from England on Wimpole Street to Italy. And for 13 years they lived and had a child. And she died in his arms in 1861. And she had written poetry. His name was Robert Browning. Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And she had written poetry about love and God, the way I'm speaking about it here. She said, love is in every blackberry. You're not eating a blackberry when you eat. You're eating God. You're consuming God. Well, here's how she put it. She said, earth's crammed with heaven. What a great line. Earth's crammed with heaven. And every common bush afire with God. And those who truly see take off their shoes while the rest sit around and pick blackberries. That was Elizabeth Barrett. She never spoke to her father again. She moved out of the energy of fear and hatred and let real, authentic love move in. And it transformed her and her poetry and her life and Robert Browning's as well. Where there is hatred, make every effort to bring love. And what is love? It says it right in the scriptures. God is love. And he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in me, and I in him. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. Where there is injury, pardon. This is about healing, whether it's physical or emotional. Bringing a sense of pardon to the presence of injury. I've just produced a tape with Hay House called The Secrets of Your Own Healing Power, in an address I gave to a chiropractic convention a while back. And the secrets of your own healing power are basically to understand, well, here's a letter that was written by a woman. Her name is Gladys McGarry, and she wrote a book called The Physician Within You. It's a wonderful book. She's a medical doctor. And she relates a conversation with her son, Carl, who had just finished his internship and was specializing in orthopedic surgery. He told his mother about his fears about having people's lives in his own hands, and she wrote him this letter. She said, "Carl, as a surgeon, you may pull an incision together and suture it well, but you cannot make it heal. If you think you are the one who does the healing, you have a right to be scared. But if you understand that you are a channel through which healing moves, and that you are contacting the healing force within your patients, you have nothing to fear. You will have awakened the physician within them and sent them on their way to heal themselves." Healing, to me, is bringing the presence of a faster and a higher energy to the presence of this thing we call injury or disease, which is really the reaction of our bodies to our minds. And our minds have, again, the illusion that we're separate from God, and therefore our bodies are commanded by a ego mind rather than a sacred mind. And that when we move ourselves, and this is one of the biggest questions that you had in all the questions I read last night and this morning, it was about, what about these people who get diseases? What about children who have diseases? What about people who get AIDS? And all of these kinds of things, and how can you ask them to take responsibility, and so on. And it's not an issue that is an easy one to deal with, because it's very emotionally entrenched. But just like starvation is part of the perfection of this universe that I don't like or agree with or understand, and so I put my attention on my desire to end it, and I know that that comes from God as well, I feel the same way about disease. I think that some children incarnate to be here for a certain amount of time. And just like my father may have shown up here to teach me compassion and forgiveness by being the kind of person he was, I think a child might show up in a body that has AIDS or in an injury or whatever. Again, if you understand and believe and know that there's a perfection to this universe and there's a force operating that holds it all together, and that we have an infinite amount of time to work this whole thing out, we begin to no longer tell ourselves that death and these kinds of things that are taking place that are so painful for us are not a part of the perfection of it all. They are. And when you begin to bring pardon to the presence of injury, what you also do is you bring a higher consciousness. And when you bring a higher consciousness, you begin to detach yourself from this body and realize that that's not who you are. I am not this thing that I occupy. And once you're detached from it, like a Helen Keller wrote some of the most powerful and beautiful and inspirational material with a body that hardly worked at all. And when a Lance Armstrong, who is diagnosed with testicular cancer, has two tumors the size of grapefruit in his stomach and in his lungs, and 14 the size of golf balls in his lung areas, and two the size of oranges in his brain, and is told to die, and his wife brings a bike and puts it at the foot of his bed, and somehow something magical, because he was told not only will you not walk again, you won't live and breathe again. He not only went past it, transcended it by looking at that bike that his wife placed at the foot of his bed, but he went to the most grueling test of physical endurance there is on the planet and won the Tour de France. After that diagnosis and that experience, the Tour de France takes 22 days. It's 2,000 plus miles through the Pyrenees, highest mountain peaks, lowest mountain peaks, every single day riding. The most grueling test of physical endurance there is. And not only did he win it once, but the next year, just to emphasize that this wasn't some fluke, he did it again. Twice. He's only the second American ever to win the thing. And he did it 2 years in a row after that cancer. And he wrote his autobiography, and it's called It's Not About the Bike. I recommend you read it. He brought something to the presence of this, and a miracle took place. And the law that has ever allowed any miracle to take place in the history of humanity, it's still on the books. It hasn't been repealed. It's there. Where there is injury, let me bring pardon. Where there is doubt, let me bring faith. Let me bring faith to the presence of doubt. And what is faith but a knowing? It's making conscious contact and being independent of the opinion of anyone else about whether you know you're in conscious contact with a frequency that is so fast and so high that it has the capacity to dissipate any energy that is lower than it. You have to know it. And faith is that awareness. Tagore put it in one of his poems. He said, faith is the sound that the songbird makes before the dawn. Before the dawn. Like, I'm singing, and I know the dawn is coming. It's still dark, but I'm singing. That's faith. That's the kind of faith you have to have. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is despair, let me bring a sense of the possibility of something working out. Hope is an energy. When you put a despairing thought on someone and test them, they will always calibrate weak. When you put a hopeful thought on someone, they will calibrate strong. Do you think you have a better chance of overcoming despair with strength or with weakness. Let me bring hope to the presence of despair, wherever it may be. In my own life, let me bring that higher spiritual awareness to the presence of that low one. Where there is darkness, light. What is darkness? The absence of purity, the absence of morality, the absence of a higher awareness. And light, whenever it is brought to the presence of darkness, always nullifies the darkness. Light is a faster, higher energy. And whenever you are in a moment of darkness, if you're in your room at night, very often when we're in the dark, we think our most morbid, fearful, shameful, predictable thoughts that things aren't going to work out, that something bad is coming, that I'm afraid that it's going to turn in a way that I don't want it to turn. And you know what to do? Turn on the light. Just turn on the light. Like, get up and turn on a light and watch what happens. That when you bring light to the presence of darkness just in the surroundings, all of a sudden you can see that it's not going to be that way. Suddenly you're saying, or the thoughts that you had in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock in the morning when you were so worried and so fearful and distant, and then you get up in the morning and you walk outside and you think, what the hell was I thinking? Why was I so afraid? Why was I predicting a disaster? Why was I thinking that something horrible was coming? Bring light to the presence of darkness. And in bringing light to the presence of darkness, it disappears. It's gone. Where there is sadness, let me bring joy. Final chapter. And the final requests of St. Francis. Where there is sadness, let me bring joy. I love this. You've heard of Gurdjieff, who had a spiritual community in France. Here's a story that John Marks Templeton tells in his wonderful book, Worldwide Laws of Life. He said there lived an old man who was the personification of difficulty, irritable, messy, fighting with everyone, unwilling to clean up or help in any manner. No one was able to get along with him. Finally, after many frustrating months of trying to stay with the group, the old man left for Paris. Gurdjieff followed him and tried to convince him to return. But it had been too hard, and the man said no. Finally, Gurdjieff offered the man a very big monthly stipend if he would return to the community. How could the man refuse? When the old man returned, everyone was aghast. Upon hearing that he was being paid, while they were being charged a fair sum just to be there, the community was up in arms. Gurdjieff called everyone together for a meeting, and after hearing all of their complaints, he laughed and explained, "This old man is like yeast for bread. Without him here, you would never really learn about anger, irritability, patience, and compassion. That is why you pay me and why I hire him with your money." Isn't that great? So when you have sadness, frustration, all of this kind of stuff, you have to figure out a way to love it. And the way that you love it is by bringing joy to it. You have to love your sadness. You have to love and appreciate that this is something that is taking you to a better and a higher place. It's exactly what I did with the story that I told you at the opening about my father and how it was the turning point in my life. How I had taken something that was sad and frustrating and angry producing and so on, how I had taken that and brought joy to it. And when you bring joy, you're bringing one of the very highest frequencies in the universe to the presence of that sadness. And sadness cannot live with joy. Do you know you can't laugh and cry at the same time? That you can't literally be sad and experience joy in the same moment. You have to take one or the other. And joy nullifies sadness. It cancels it. It trumps it, if you will. And all of these higher emotions that St. Francis begged Jesus to teach him. And you know, there was a miracle that took place that Costanzakis spoke about in the St. Francis novel. It was the most moving moment in the novel for me. I mean, it's really hard for me to say this without getting tearful. St. Francis was terrified of lepers. And in the 12th and 13th centuries, lepers wore a bell. And wherever they would walk, the bell would sound so that people were warned to stay away from them because it was so contagious, this disease. St. Francis was terrified of them. And in his meditation and his prayer, remember, St. Francis, in the last years of his life, had the stigmata, the wounds of Christ. He became Christ. He experienced, at the emotional level, all of the pain that Jesus experienced with his crucifixion. And he heard in his prayer, when he was conversing with God, that he was told that when you're walking into the next village, before you get there, there will be a leper. And he will approach you on the road as you are walking with Brother Leone. And that leper will have his mouth half eaten away by the disease. And you are to go up to that leper and put your arms around him and kiss him full on the mouth. And as he told Brother Leo this, what a horror it was, Brother Leo said, let's just go the other direction. Because Brother Leo was always saying, you know, I'm just not into this hunger thing. I'm not into this being cold thing. You know, I know, but I'm cold and I'm hungry. And he was always thinking about a glass of wine. And he was always thinking about a nice big sandwich, with a chicken that he could eat and so on. And Francesco would always chastise him for his weakness. But he always loved him despite it. And he always talked and spoke about his weaknesses and how Francesco would love his deprivations and his poverty and so on. So Francesco, he said, you don't understand. I must. I must do it because Christ has commanded me to do it. And it is how I will overcome my hatred, my sadness about leprosy. And sure enough, as they were walking towards the village, he heard the bell, and fear overcame him. But he transcended the fear, and he ran to the leper as fast as he could, so he could do it quickly. And he put his arms around the leper, and he kissed him full on the mouth. And then he took the leper, who was just a little boy, and he put him under his robe, and he carried him into the city under his robe, to present to the people his willingness to bring joy and the love of God to the presence of so much sadness. And when he opened his robe, the leper was gone. And he said, Christ appeared to me as a leper to test me if I could show that kind of love. And then he left and disappeared. It's one of the authenticated miracles of St. Francis being an incarnation of Christ 13 centuries later. I didn't think I could get through that story. Where there is sadness, let me bring joy. The joy of knowing that you have nothing to fear. I'd like to close with a reading It's a reading from the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita, of course, is the song of the Lord. I've told you the legend of Bagger Vance by Stephen Pressfield. I'd recommend, by the way, that you read that. Now I think if you read it, you'll have an understanding of how it applies. And Arjuna is Juna, and Bagger is Bagger Vance. And the Bhagavad Gita is the story of Arjuna the charioteer and this charioteer who is really Krishna, God. And he's about to fight and go into battle on the great battlefield, lined up with all of his warriors. And he speaks to his charioteer, who turns out to be God, as Bagger Vance is to Juna. And here's a conversation they have. And it really is how I ended the book. I won't put what I said after each one of these interactions. You can read that when the book comes out. But I want to share with you this conversation between Arjuna and Krishna, so that you'll understand there is a spiritual solution to every problem. And it didn't originate with me. This was written thousands of years before any of us were on this planet. Arjuna, tell me of those who live always in wisdom, even aware of the self, O Krishna. How do they talk? How sit? How move about? Krishna, they live in wisdom who see themselves in all and all in them, whose love for the Lord of love has consumed every selfish desire and sense craving tormenting the heart. Krishna. Further, he says, not agitated by grief or hankering after pleasure, they live free from lust and fear and anger. Fettered no more by selfish attachments, they are not elated by good fortune or depressed by bad. Such are the seers. Even as a tortoise draws in its limbs, the wise draw in their senses at will. Krishna goes on. Though aspirants abstain from sense pleasure, they will still crave for them. These cravings all disappear when they see the Lord of love. For even of those who tread the path, the stormy senses can sweep off the mind, but they live in wisdom who subdue them and keep their minds ever absorbed in me, God. Krishna goes on. When you keep thinking about sense objects, an attachment comes. Attachment breeds desire. The lust of possession, which when thwarted, turns to anger. Anger clouds the judgment. You can no longer learn from past mistakes. Lost is the power to choose between the wise and unwise. And your life is utter waste. But when you move amidst the world of sense, from both attachments and aversion freed, there comes the peace in which all sorrows and you live in the wisdom of the self. Krishna. The disunited mind is far from wise. How can it meditate? How be at peace? When you know no peace, how can you choose joy? Krishna, use all your power to set the senses free from attachment and aversion alike and live in the full wisdom of the self. Such a sage awakes to light in the night of all creatures. That which the world calls day is the night of ignorance to the wise. Krishna, as the rivers flow into the ocean, but cannot make the vast ocean overflow, so flow the magic streams of the sense world into the sea of peace that is the sage. And finally, they are forever free, who break away from the ego cage of I, me, and mine, to be united with the Lord of love. This is the supreme state. Attain to this and pass from death to immortality. That's Krishna speaking to Arjuna in a segment from the Bhagavad Gita. I attended a talk by a great teacher. His name is Swami Satchitananda. And he explained the difference between illness and wellness. He said, illness is a disease of the ego. It starts with the letter I. And when we are in any kind of illness, we are believing that we are alone. And we go to our ego. He said, wellness begins with the letters we. And when you're in wellness, you always see yourself as connected to the highest source available. And that's the difference between wellness and illness. And it's the difference between problems and no problems. In every moment of your life, every moment, as you leave here today, remember you have this choice. You can either be a host to God or a hostage to your ego. It's up to you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
This has been a Hay House audiobook production. If you would like a free catalog of audio cassettes, books, and videos offered by Hay House, please call us at 1-800-654-5126. Thank you for listening.